Osiris. Folks, I'm David Goldstein.
Hi, I'm Brian Brinkman.
You are tuned in to a bit of a bonus episode of the Beyond the Pond podcast. Generally speaking, as you may be aware by now, this is the podcast in which Brian and myself utilize the music of Phish as a means of introducing the listener to other bands, generally non-jam bands, because we love Phish. We are Phish fans, big Phish fans. But the problem with some Phish fans is that they get a bit myopic, they kind of need to go outside the box, and they get stuck listening to Phish and Phish alone. So we're trying to do a little something about that.
Absolutely. And we've got a really cool interview and conversation here for you today. In today's episode, we sat down recently with the writer and traveler, Grayson Curran, talk a bit about his travels. He's been on the road for the better part of the last 14 months, I think it is, with his wife and his cat, traveling around North America in a giant van, going to some pretty cool remote spots and kind of weaving in and out of the country here and there. They've run a bunch of marathons, just some really awesome stuff that they've been up to. Grayson also is a writer who wrote two articles that we really enjoyed over the last year, one about kind of the experience of traveling in rural parts of America and listening to CDs because you run out of bandwidth for your Apple Music or Spotify and kind of what that's like as a throwback, as well as he wrote a really cool article about a lot of the artist movement towards artist curated festivals and kind of how that's changing the landscape. And then finally, we wanted to talk to him about his kind of long-running fandom with the Dave Matthews Band and how he went from being a fan of Dave Matthews to being basically the head metal writer at Pitchfork. So it's a pretty wide-ranging conversation. It was a ton of fun, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was absolutely fun. He's clearly he's a very soulful guy, and he's been certainly been one of my favorite Pitchfork writers for a long time now. Like you said, lots of metal records, lots of instrumental stuff, sort of some more of the avant out there stuff. Also, recently did a fantastic review of Bob Dylan's Time Out of Mind for, I guess recently Pitchfork, they started doing on Sundays, they take a classic record and devote like a long form essay to it. And his write up of Time Out of Mind was most excellent. So, yeah, this was a very interesting conversation. Lots of good back and forth. I think it came out well. And, you know, I was absolutely fascinated by what this guy had to say. So, anything else? Or should we just get to it?
I say we get to it. There's a lot of content here. And we're going to play some music in between some of our conversations as some bands come up. But I think that if you guys like what we do here at Beyond the Pond, if you like the music that we've recommended, I think you're just going to really enjoy a lot of what Grayson has to say about music in general and about some of our favorite acts.
I think Adam Duritz and Dave Matthews are both in a similar spot where they need someone to step in and like not like record their record, but like actually almost like Rick Rubin kind of vibe session, like, hey, let's talk about your priorities and let's talk about what your actual interests are in life besides entertaining 10 to 20,000 people at a time. Like, what, let's make a record that is more consistent with those reflections on life. And not just a crowd pleaser. I don't know. I feel like maybe those two guys have something left in the tank. I mean, they got to get like the right engine to help them get it out or something.
I mean, I think it's interesting because I think back to your review of Time Out of Mind, and I think if you go back to like late 80s, early 90s Dylan, I was really young at the time. I was not a Dylan fan yet, but I can't really imagine, and reading Chronicles, I can't really imagine a lot of people expecting him to make another monumental record. And then somehow he had in him one of his best records he's ever made. When he was, how old was he when he made Time Out of Mind? Like mid-50s at that point in time?
Yeah, that's right. Late 50s, I think.
Late 50s. And I feel like that's like the model that someone like Dave Matthews or Adam Duritz would be looking to, is like, what do you have to say when you're the elder statesman that you simply couldn't say when you were 25 years old, when everybody thought you had peaked, that can like change the trajectory of your career, which then creates that like really unique hindsight period where people start to look at the records that they dismissed in the moment, but actually find a lot of gems in. Like, you look at a lot of 80s Dylan now that's getting revived simply because he made such great work in his later years.
I mean it's a weird point. It's a interesting debate because people all say like, man, you just don't want to hear a good Dave Matthews record anymore. You couldn't even recognize it if it happened. And I'm like, yeah. I would totally love to hear a good Dave Matthews record, a record that did something interesting. I think that would be so fun.
I think a lot of Dave Matthews' problems to me, I mean, kind of starting with a lot of overproduction. I mean,
oh, yeah, every day.
That was the, like, Glenn Ballard disaster that came out in, like, February 2001. That was not good.
Yep.
Yeah, I kind of certainly... I'll still ride for the first three albums. That was before the production got out of hand. Even before, These Crowded Streets had some pretty good songs, but it was getting totally very good. Slick.
Really. I don't know. I really disagree with that. I don't think Before These Crowded Streets gets slick. I think Before These Crowded Streets, and this is just my opinion, obviously, I feel like Before These Crowded Streets is kind of trying to sort of have two conversations at once. Okay. And you can sort of see that bear out with Every Day and the Little Light Sessions if you look at them like together. And one conversation is like, we want to be a radio band. And so like you go, you know, like Stay and, you know, Every Day, the song, aren't that far apart. Right. And also like Monkey Man or Kit Kat Jam or whatever, and Don't Drink the Water, or The Dreaming Tree are really similar. They're like these two, and so I think like they're just like battling twin impulses, and that's why I think Before These Crowded Streets to me is so interesting, because it's a record where you see them like reckon with themselves and say, what the fuck are we trying to be as a band? And then they like had that conversation out loud, and we were lucky enough because I think it was like, what is it, like four people had copies. Apparently four people had copies of what they called Summer So Far, I guess, which was the Little Light Sessions.
Yes.
Hmm.
And somehow we got to hear them, and we got to peek behind that curtain and say, whoa, you know, like, it. How? And I think that's so, and so,
I'll I don't never know forget this... when I first got a copy of the Lily White Sessions and I heard it. I think it was summer 2001. Was that right after Every Day came out that emerged?
Yeah, it was. I think it was going to be released. They thought it was too blue. So that's when he put out Every Day and he's like, this record saved my life.
Right.
When in fact, the Lily White Sessions were, to my mind, like 800 times better.
Yes.
Standing here, the old man said to me, long before these crowded streets, here stood my dreaming tree. Below it he would sit for hours at a time. Now progress takes away what forever took to find, and now is falling hard. He feels the falling dark, how it longs to be.
So in January, I went to Chicago, flew from Phoenix to Chicago, where Riley Walker was doing a complete re-recording of the Little Light Sessions.
Holy crap.
Wait, really? What?
Yeah, and it's finished. It's totally
Holy shit.
And amazing. So we're just finishing it. I just wrote the liner notes for it, and I just sort of kind of stumbled my way through the bio for it this evening.
Oh, my God.
And I got to turn that in today. But so I think, like, what we're talking about, so Riley is sort of more generous toward the Latter-day Dave Matthews Band than I am.
Yeah.
But we both kind of agree that, like, that's the record where the sense of possibility that existed for that band kind of peaked.
Yeah.
And when they turned to Everyday, it disappears. Right. Like, they came back to some of those songs, of course, on Busted Stuff, but they're a lot more stiff. They're less fun. And calling the Lily White Sessions fun is kind of a stretch anyway, but I mean fun in the sense that, like, it feels like they're exploring Absolutely. A new space as a band.
Yeah.
And after that, and I think for a lot of people, that's kind of like where they checked out the band.
That was my
point.
I had just lost track after Lily White Sessions. I didn't listen to Stand Up or Big Whiskey and the Gruvette's King or any of that.
Yeah, it's weird, too, because, you know, I wrote this piece for NPR about the band, and I went back and listened to everything that they made. And, you know, like, in all those records, maybe there were, like, six songs. I was like, oh, wow, these songs are good. Like, they're like two songs a record. It's kind of the Duritz problem.
Yeah.
They're like two songs a record here that I could totally vouch for if it came down to it. But it's just, I don't know, it's just kind of a mess. It's just no one to sort of guide the ship. And it's sort of like this fulfillment of, it's sort of a guy trying to fulfill this obligation he thinks he has to a fan base.
Right.
And doesn't quite know how to do it.
It's funny.
Well, that was the impression I got from the interview with David Marchese in like Vulture, New York Magazine. Right.
My brother was just visiting me, and he and I like always like cross paths and then diverge paths in terms of music. And he was like, "Don't hate me, but I'm going through kind of a Dave Matthews Renaissance right now." And
yeah,
it kind of piqued my curiosity because I hadn't really revisited their older stuff in some time. And so we started listening to some live shows, and we threw on Remember Two Things and Before These Crowded Streets. And anyway, we had a bunch of people over for dinner, and we were all having some drinks and sitting around our table out in the back of our house. And I threw on the Red Rock show, Seek Up. And instantly, it was like a vinyl scratch. Someone was like, "Is this Dave Matthews?" And I was like, "Yeah." And immediately started this conversation that I thought was fascinating. Dave Matthews, to me and to a lot of people I know to my age, are like one of the most influential bands that we ever heard. And they
absolutely
like opened my eyes to what was possible in music. And then I left them behind and almost am like, not embarrassed, but like I don't like proudly say that in a lot of ways. And re-listening to them, I was like, I totally hear that connection once again. Like I hear like these like filters like reconnecting to each other in a way. It was really interesting.
I mean, this is entirely this is entirely what you're talking about is the point of the Riley thing. And so those you know the Riley songs. You know, Dig in a Ditch now sounds like a Dinosaur Jr. single, and Grace is Gone still sounds like a better version of Grace is Gone.
Yeah.
Bartender.
Bartender sounds like a fucking Swans and Akron Family collaboration.
I mean,
which is kind of the way it always sounded, but now it just sounds like turned up for like it sounds bigger and badder. Can you guys hear me okay?
Oh yeah, you're
yeah.
I'm desperately walking around Omaha trying to find a power plug so that my phone doesn't go out of charge. But if it does, I'll figure out some way to call you back.
Cool.
Real fast.
We can hear you. I'm trying to find
the van seems to be filtering the signal. So Bartender, and you know, there's some totally free jazz stuff. There's some straight up funk jams, and it's a map, really. And the way I talk about it is, it's a map of where, of the sort of roads that the Dave Matthews Band helped lead Riley to. And I think that's true of so many people, and it's true of so many music critics and musicians I talk to. And I think it's a thing that for a long time people are ashamed of, because yeah. it's like this weird stigma, and I get that, but it's also, it's silly. Cause we're all just like, you know, kids that stumble into whatever record we stumble into, and maybe that leads us somewhere interesting.
Before These Crowded Streets, that album's kind of interesting for me because that was released in April, I think, of 1998, which was my freshman year of college. So on my dorm, on the floor, I was in the first floor, there would be five doors open, all playing that record at the same time. So it'd be like the ultimate Dave Matthews mega matchup. Thinking, and also, I mean, I went to high school in the Northeast, went to college in Jersey, and it just, you know, what's some of the elements of the Dave Matthews shows in the parking lots, I'd see like rival high schools from Connecticut getting drunk and getting into brawls. And although I know it doesn't have anything to do with the music, it kind of clouded my vision a bit, thinking of like, are these the people I really want to hang out at the concert? If they're like beating themselves bloody before going into the show, if they go into the show at all, it's
sure.
I've like, I guess over the years I've gotten better at like separating some of their fans from the music itself. And I, those, God, the first three records, like, fucking Under the Table and Dreaming, I still, I'll listen to that album any day of the week.
Production on the Warehouse is still one of my favorite things that they've ever made.
It's a great song. Absolutely.
So I'm curious, and this is kind of, it's funny because there's like three articles that we had read of yours over the last year or so that like really drew us to wanting to talk with you. And one of them was your piece in NPR about Dave Matthews and kind of the journey you talked about and kind of where you were in terms of like confusion and frustration with the band at this point in time. For me, like I said earlier, like Busted Stuff was... that was the last album I really cared about from them. And even that felt like a, I don't know, like you said, like it wasn't as loose as the Lily White Sessions. It felt like they like kind of buttoned up this album and like made it like a half everyday, half Lily White Sessions record.
Sure.
And right around that time was when I got into Phish, and that was like that next step for me. And I'm curious, like, just based off of like all the writing that like we've read of yours, especially like your Dave Matthews fandom, did you ever have like a Phish period, or was that like just something you missed like on purpose, or just like just it like passed you by, or what was that ever like a part of like your listening?
I did not try to miss Phish. A lot of my friends were into Phish, and into Phish in ways that were really pivotal to their musical development. And I tried to get into Phish. I sort of deliberately tried. I went to some shows. I listened to records. I listened to bootlegs and some official live releases. And I think the reason that I didn't get into Phish, and I'm sure that Phish fans will be like, dude, you're getting it wrong. when I say this, is that from listening to the Dave Matthews Band, I think there are a few ways you can go. And I got really interested in idea versus technique. And right now, Fish fans just groaned. But what I mean by that is that so my sort of arrow out of the Dave Matthews Band was the Dave Matthews Band into Neil Young, into Sonic Youth, into Tony Conrad. And Tony Conrad is is a guy that sort of, I guess, the like most famous anecdote is he named the Velvet Underground. He was John Kell's roommate. This bum named Lou Reed, male model named Lou Reed, moved in for a while. He named the Velvet Underground. But more importantly to me, he was, I think, sort of the great underrated or overlooked minimalist composer of 20th century music in the United States. And when I heard his music, which I had heard because of Sonic Youth, it really just sort of inspired my interest in noise and minimalism. And from there, you know, heavy metal, which is a weird path, I suppose. But kind of in that pathway, I kind of ran tangentially to Fish a lot. Mm-hmm. And there were often like songs that I would hear, and I'm like, oh, this is a cool song, you know, or this is a cool idea. Or I would read about, you know, Fish's festivals or their ideas. And it was always interesting to me, but it never sort of crossed it was never the main thing I was thinking about. Though it was often very close to the main thing I was thinking about. So it's weird. It's a band that that I almost tried to get into, okay. But I think I was being pulled in such different ways that it wasn't. It was never my main interest. I don't think I would. So I would say I never went through a Fish phase, but I probably went through a phase of trying to have Fish phases. If that makes sense.
That does.
Come on, baby.
Even if you had said really positive things about you know, your love for Phish. Phish fans would have grown no matter what. It's just their nature.
Oh, man, totally. So, a person who's a personal friend, has been for a long time, and I think, I don't even know if we're that different in age, but who I've considered kind of a mentor and I look up to is Jesse Giorno.
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. And Jesse knows a whole lot about Phish, yeah, obviously, but Jesse also raises the ire of more Phish fans than I guess any other human alive. So many of my friends and mentors and, you know, musicians that I sort of came of age with were Phish fans, and it just is never, it's not even a thing I can pretend to pose about, like being, like knowing a ton about. It's just something that I kept missing for whatever reason.
I don't know if Jesse, I'm trying to think if he raises the ire of Phish fans so much as he was unduly smeared by that Phish book written by Park Poudrabaugh a few years ago, which kind of obliquely accused him of writing a really bad review of the really, really, really bad Vegas 2004 shows.
And caused Phish to break up, right? Like, that's right. Like the urban legend about Jesse is he's the guy that...
The urban legend is that he was approached by the bassist and said, thanks for breaking up my band.
No hard feelings.
Hey, I at least know the bassist's name. So that's some cred.
There you go. We would go on record here and say that they should have broken up after that Vegas run. It was probably the most embarrassing run I've ever seen for a band that I truly love. So I don't think he was wrong.
It was certainly levels of like Grateful Dead, Spring 95, very, very unprofessional. Obviously something was wrong.
Sure.
So, yeah, you know.
It's interesting you talk about, you know, your arrow out of the Dave Matthews Band, because I was raised on, like, Neil Young, Bruce Springsteen, and U2, and I discovered Dave Matthews Band early high school, and kind of right around the time that Crash came out, that was, I think, the first album that I was old enough where I was buying CDs and I really connected with. And I came from the Midwest, so it wasn't like they were still growing at that point in time. But,
sure.
You know, I remember listening to Dave Matthews, and he really helped me to gain an appreciation for the singer-songwriter, which led me back to Neil Young, helped me discover Bob Dylan and a bunch of other artists. But for me, it was like jams off of, like, Two Step and Jimmy Thing that I listened to that I found really interesting, that they would, like, just stretch this song out for 10 to 19 minutes. And when I heard Phish do it and they took it in even different directions, that was the thing that latched onto me. So it's interesting, and I think it speaks to the, you know, overall value of the band and the overall power that they hold, that they can push people in so many different directions. Like, I ended up in the Velvet Underground years later, oddly enough, because of Phish covering the Velvet Underground. That's funny.
I think that's totally the power of it. And I think that's, you know, I think that's why that music, you know, with or without, you know, on or not on its own merits, I think that's why that music deserves pretty serious consideration at this point, because it did cause so many people to go in one way or the other. And, you know, sort of no matter where you went after that, you know, it's a family tree, I mean, essentially. And I think a lot of people have been embarrassed by, you know, that trunk of their tree for a while, if you will, because it's corny. I mean, right? It's, you know, it's, there's a lot of corny, bad things to say about the Dave Matthews Band. But I think for a lot of people, and, you know, Riley grew up in Rockford, Illinois, and, you know, an hour away from Chicago, kind of separated from its culture and music and its scene, so to speak. And that music sort of served as a bridge. And I grew up as a kid in the country of North Carolina, and that music to me sort of opened up the idea of what music could be. And I think you're saying the same thing And all those arrows can zig and zag in a million different ways. But none of it is something we should be ashamed of.
Right, right.
If you, you know, as long as you're not still being like, Crash is the greatest song written and I'll fucking defend it until the day I die. Because it's a great song.
Maybe Line or Grave, it's not Crash.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I've recently been listening back to that song, and like the way the rhythm of that song kind of increases and picks up as the song builds. I mean, it's really beautiful, but it's not the greatest song ever written.
Right.
It was good in Lady Bird.
It was great in Lady Bird because it accelerates in the back.
All right.
Anyway, yeah.
So, just shifting gears a bit, Will.
Of course.
One of the other essays that you had written recently was about. Oh, I'm sorry. Just listen to what's going on there. Was about artist curated festivals. So sure. With such just like a focus in the music industry on live music, I mean, do you see like large scale festivals like the Coachellas? Now here we have like Governor's Ball and Panorama. I mean, you think those are like a necessary evil, or do you see like the artist curated festivals being the future? I mean, I know one that really comes to mind was the one that the National just put on down in Cincinnati that I considered going to. Wasn't able to get out there.
I don't even know if I would say that the right word is evil. I think that large festival culture is simply a symptom of the time we're living in. And I don't think it's an accident that the large festivals of this country happened somewhat in conjunction with the rise of our accessibility to the internet and Napster. Okay. And then iTunes and the iPod. And, you know, I think they are sort of smorgasbords where instant access to most of the things you want is there. And I think that's great. I started a music festival that still exists in North Carolina called Hopscotch. I like music festivals because they're a great way to see so much stuff in a really short amount of time and have interesting experiences. And that can go for something really small or it can go for something really big. But I think the problem that has developed in music festivals is that there's a formula there, and the formula can be observed and copied and you know, sold with infinite slight variations. And that's fine. But I think there can be something more interesting, and that sort of as listeners and fans of music, we should hope for something more interesting.
Right.
And I think that's what artist-curated festivals... Tell me if you can't hear me, because I'm still trying to find a power outlet.
You're good.
Oh, I think I found one. I'm at a used car dealership. Here we go. About to plug in. I think that that we should demand things that are more interesting. We should demand that festivals can deliver experiences that we wouldn't have at an ordinary concert hall. That, you know, if I go to see the National, for instance, like you mentioned, at the National in Richmond, Virginia, then the National are going to play their songs. That's cool. That's what I'm here for. Right. But if I go to a festival where, let's say, 50 different bands that I really like, or 50 different bands are playing and 30 of them are bands I really like, and 20 of them are bands that I either don't know much about or I don't really care about, maybe something interesting and unexpected will happen. Or maybe what I will learn from that festival is something more about the way my favorite band thinks, or what they believe in artistically or politically or socially or emotionally. And I think that's the hope of an artist curated festival, which is that, A, you can have experiences that aren't just about commerce and that aren't necessarily easily sellable, and that you can have experiences that allow you to connect with music you really, with art you really love.
What did you think of, I guess, the one up in Wisconsin this past weekend, Eau Claire's, with the one?
So one of the friends I mentioned who was really into fish is Justin Vernon.
Sure.
We lived together in North Carolina for a time, along with Brad Cook, who's his manager, who's in Megaphone, with Phil Cook and Joe Westerlund. They were all big fish fans. They were kind of the ones that were like, hey, you got to listen to fish more. It's like, yeah, Tony Conrad. and... I've been trying to go to this festival for years. And this year it seemed like we maybe would make it. But we didn't for various reasons. But I think what Justin is doing is kind of beautiful. You know, I think what he's doing and what he and Aaron are doing together and, you know, with various partners is trying to create an atmosphere where what we embrace is music and art. And, you know, it's precious. I think it's, you know, precious by nature. And I think they realize that it's precious and that it seems kind of pie in the sky. But that's fine. I kind of think that what they're doing is exercising privilege in some way. Mm-hmm. And exercising privilege in a way that I think we should all exercise privilege more, which is recognizing that, like, I am a rich person, not even rich. I'm a person who's made money and has been successful making music. So I have the ability to exert some influence on the market and to say, I can envision the market in which I want to exist and in which I want to make art. And, you know, that is by nature going to invoke criticism. I have a friend, another dear friend, who calls Justin's festival glamping, which I think is pretty funny, but I think is ultimately pretty reductive. And I think it's more about trying to create a spirit whereby people can share a moment and can create a moment and then share it. And I don't really know of a – I mean, you guys are fish fans. What better moment is there, right? Like, then when – then when 20,000 people or whatever, you know, then 20 people are watching something and freaking out together. I mean, that's an incredible thing. That's like, that's the spirit that I want to, it's got to be great to just watch a band in the field of 50,000 people and be like, yeah, I know this song. This is a cool song. I like this song. That's fine. But I think I would rather spend my money to freak out over something that, like, I had no idea would exist and is just a sheerly magnetic moment. And I'll be honest, I've barely looked at my phone this week, so I don't really know what happened at that festival in Wisconsin, which I'm ashamed to admit. I think there were some Gillian Welch covers, which I've heard about.
Yeah.
And I know that my friend Nick Sanborn and my friend Chris Rosenau improvised together, which I'm excited to hear at some point. But I don't know what else happened, but the spirit of it, I think, is absolutely right.
The National played in the round, I think.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, they had Sharon, I think, like Sharon Vedette.
Oh, yeah, Sharon was there. Yep.
Julian Baker came up and she played, I think she played one of her songs and then segued it into Fake Empire. And my brother was at the show and said that she started, she sang the first verse of Fake Empire, and then the band came in, and it was just like this kind of surprise moment that, you know, you've never heard that song live played like that. And I think it's
great.
Yeah, I think it's the big debate of, like, you know, I'm in full agreement. I mean, I've been to a lot of music festivals. I've been to everything from, you know, small, like, local festivals to, like, your mid-size, like, Pitchfork to, like, Lollapalooza and Bonnaroo. And, you know, I think the challenge is that the large ones, even the mid-size ones to a certain degree, you get bands that play, like, a festival set. You know, you want them to play something really special, but they know how many eyes are on them at that weekend. And, you know, like, how many new potential listeners there are, how many people within the industry are probably there, how many other artists are there that are, you know, just watch, you know, how many, and in a place like Pitchfork, how many writers are there and what impact that can have. And so they want to compact everything about them that's special into 45 minutes or, you know, an hour, sure, which in some cases tends to make an artist less special. You know, I know I've seen a lot of festival sets where I kind of walked away from a band I loved feeling like I just saw, like, you know, an Austin City Limits set that didn't necessarily surprise me in any sort of a way.
Sure.
And I definitely agree. I think and I feel like this year for Eau Claire, like, the big goal was, can we draw a massive crowd without telling anyone what the lineup is?
Yeah.
And I feel like from a success standpoint, you know, you definitely got a lot of, like, Justin Vernon's Rolodex, basically. Like, here's the people that I know. Let's get them, you know, on board. But I think at the same sense, and I saw pictures and videos from it, I wasn't there, but it seemed to really emphasize, like, there was a picture I saw of the Dessner brothers playing in what looked like a manufactured treehouse, where one of them was on one side of it, the other one was, like, up a ladder, and they were just playing their guitars together. I didn't hear what they were playing, but I can only imagine they were improvising together. I feel like that spirit of it, where you basically take the music and incorporate it with the artwork, that always kind of seems separate to me at a lot of festivals, and those, like, kind of mesh together, that only is a positive for music fans going forward.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, I think that any of those people would recognize the benefit of, in talking to them and reporting, all those people that you mentioned would recognize the sort of benefit of large music festivals, you know, the ones that have, to be reductive about it, a big payday.
Right.
You know, those are the festivals that help pay the crew. Those are the festivals that help keep the band in business.
Totally.
And those are the festivals that I think hopefully allow artists to follow their fancy. And if following their fancy means creating a community of people to come together and, you know, host a few thousand strangers who become friends for a weekend, why not? I think that's a pretty good money-losing endeavor, and is sympathetic with the way it's consistent with the way I think about music. I think about art, especially the live concert. I think there's also a benefit to sort of those festival sets. You know, I think there are a lot of people who, you know, people have jobs and people have kids and people have pets and they have hobbies, and everyone isn't as devoted to listening to every new record every Friday or whatever. And so, like, if you can go stand in a field and be like, yep, I like this band, I'm going to check them out on Monday, or nah, fuck this, I'm not into it, that's fine. Like, that's totally useful. And all festivals don't have to be the same. So I think the real point of an artist-curated festival is offering that alternative, offering something different than the slick. Like, here are the 150 bands that are going to play in this big field on these five stages. Deal with it. So it doesn't have to be for everyone, really, and that's fine. I think it's an important alternative to have, and I don't think that every festival should or would become that. I just think it's a really important option to exist. And I think, you know, Justin's thing or the Nationals thing or Chance the Rapper's thing a few years ago, or so, you know, and obviously this, you know, this obviously has existed. I got some criticism with that story from Fish fans, no doubt.
Oh, why? Because not talking about
the great talk about Wind Fish. Or,
right.
Yeah, because I don't, and I'll say this clearly, I don't think that the Fish festivals are in the same spirit. I think the Fish festivals are most often, you guys tell me if I'm wrong, please. I think the Fish festivals more often than not are mostly like, oftentimes Fish playing almost all the shows, or Fish playing sort of the bulk of the shows, and their buddies, like I guess Del McCurry's played a few, and you know, like those folks existing more on the periphery or stepping in at some points. I think these other festivals that I'm talking about are...
Yeah, the Fish festivals are just entirely Fish. I know...
They're Fish.
Yeah.
They are,
yeah.
Fish festivals.
They're basically big Fish shows. Yeah, yeah, the Fish festivals. Right, yeah, right.
I'm glad that this distinction is clear to you guys, because I was like,
oh, yeah.
They're totally different ideas. You know, I think that sort of... Chance the Rapper, Bon Iver, Martin Medeski Wood and Friends thing is a really good way to go to allow people to experience unique moments.
Right.
And, you know, I think that idea is totally an idea that has existed in the jam band scene for a long time and expanded. One of the pieces of that story that didn't survive for I think a few valid reasons was about the Horde Festival. There was a long section about, not a long section, but a pretty meaty section about the Horde Festival. I think there might have been a quote from John Popper that made it, but you know, I think that what they did was totally part of what happens now, and the spirit of sharing. You know, they had this second stage where, you know, the bands would play their festival set, sure, but then they would hop on the second stage, and who knows what would happen. Mm-hmm. You know, Neil Young and John Popper could be playing a John Hartford song. You know, who knows? And I think that is the spirit that should exist, where collaboration can happen and surprises can happen. And I think that's what we want to get from festivals. Not to be too, you know, Golden Gate Park about it, but I think we want experiences. And you know, I'm down to pay for that.
What kind of festivals exist for people who want to see a lot of metal at once? I know there's Maryland Death Fest. I'm just trying to think of ones other than that.
There's a really good festival run by, oh man, this is something I'm totally blanking. Is it Gilead Media? Gilead Media runs a good festival in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
Okay.
And Gilead's a great label. A lot of metal otherwise. Let's see. They're not a lot right now. There's a Psychofest in Las Vegas. And this year's lineup is really good. And I'm kind of thinking about flying to it. I don't know. We'll see. It's in September. But, you know, it's pretty niche. Metal's popularity, I think, is... You know, there are always like Carolina Rebellion or whatever, the monster, whatever.
Rock on the Range, Carolina Rebellion, the kind of like the ones that mix like the 80s metal bands with like Disturbed and Papa Roach. And then you'll have. Yeah,
it's like the Scorpions and Stone Sour and some Rob Zombie project and Baby Metal.
Right.
I went to one of those last year and it was really confusing. It was fun, but it was confusing. So those kinds of things exist, but I don't know. I've had better times watching music, but Psychofest in Vegas. There's also this new festival in Tennessee that Sleep is playing this year with some pretty good bands. I think like Windhand is playing. That's in maybe September, October. But I think metal is sort of being folded into these larger festival configurations.
Because I think because Sleep's playing Sleep is playing Hopscotch this year, right?
Sleep's playing Hopscotch, yep. They played, okay. I think, in year four, and which is my last year, and I guess they're playing year, I guess this is nine. Yeah.
Okay.
One thing I wanted to ask you about just regarding, you know, festivals is this kind of ties into, we had a really good conversation with Stephen Hyde, and shortly after his book Twilight of the Gods came out. And one of the aspects of that book that really attracted me to it was this idea that classic rock was almost leaving the white male hero behind. And you talked a lot in your essay about the impact of these festivals being led by people of color, by women. And, you know, there's so much more diversity nowadays in rock music and in popularized music than there was even 10, 20, 30 years ago. Do you see these kind of artist-curated festivals as, like, the best path forward for, you know, kind of underserved populations from a musical standpoint to, like, really kind of be in their own element, to gain notoriety, to really have, like, the freedom to create? Like, do you see that being any part of it?
I want to make sure I understand the question, because it's certainly a meaty one. Do I think that, like, these sorts of festivals are the best way for those underserved demographics to have this microphone, so to speak?
Yeah.
I don't think physical spaces are, I think hopefully in the future the answer is yes.
Okay.
But I think that something about those festivals and those experiences is that they require a lot of capital. And they require a lot of social capital. They require a lot of financial capital. They require a lot of political capital. And I don't think that we have, as a bunch of white dudes, essentially allowed that always to happen. And I hope that in the future it does. And I think it's sort of incumbent upon us to make sure it does and to bring more voices to the table. And I think there are people who are doing that work, and they deserve all the support and platforms that they can get from people who already produce those festivals. I think the internet is sort of, you know, the internet, which would be not this physical space that we're talking about, right, is kind of the platform you're talking about.
That makes sense.
Because I think that, you know, requires less of those, certainly requires some capital, but less. So I'm hoping that is something that over the next 5 to 10 years we really see happen. And I think is important to see for people to support. I don't think it's the great redeemer or anything. I think it's the great redeemer in the sense that, like, it gives artists more control over how they present their music and how they enjoy a festival experience. But I still think if you look at the numbers and the sort of divide, it's a mostly male and especially white male demographic in charge of you.
Right.
Speaking of that type of demographic, what did you think of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
Oh, man. Oh, you've been on my Twitter. Rock and Roll Hall of Fame was really odd. I was very excited to go. I'd never been. And it was a confusing experience. I'll say that. You know, there's so much cool stuff in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. You got to give it that. Like, the first thing to say about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is you will go there, and no matter who you are, you will probably see something where you go, oh shit, that's a real-life physical object that exists. Like, you'll watch Michael Jackson's glove rotate in a cylinder very slowly. Or you'll see Mother Maybelle's guitar. Or you'll see
suitcase where Howlin' Wolf kept his money.
Exactly. Or you'll see, like, salvage bits of Otis Redding's plane. Or you'll see Kim Gordon's bass. Or you see all these things. But then it's like there's this, like, this overwhelming vibe that it's also a guitar center mixed with, like, a really weird consignment store. And, like, you could be like, how much is that one? And so there's that vibe. And there's also like this weird, and I don't quite know how to parse this. There's this weird impulse in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame to sort of tell the larger story of music in the United States. Mm. And so you're trying to say a little bit about hip hop. You're trying to say a little bit about jazz. You're trying to say a little bit about country, a little bit about the blues, but they're all subservient to rock and roll.
Right.
And it's almost like, guys, just be like, you know, here's a sign that has these other things, and here's rock and roll. It's just such a weird format for trying to share a unified story that kind of doesn't exist. Like, they try to make a unified story by not making a unified story. And I've been really trying to parse this idea of what they're trying to say, and I don't think it's totally successful. Like, for instance, I think you could probably go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame if you knew nothing about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or rock and roll, and you could leave and say, rock and roll was invented by Bruce Springsteen, but there was also this guy named Robert Johnson, and no one knows anything about him. The end.
Right.
And yeah, also, there were five people inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year, but they get like half of a floor. That's it.
Yeah, when I went back in 2013, I had a very – I mean, I kind of went expecting to hate it. And me and my wife spent like 3.5 hours there just because if you're huge music fans, there's so much minutia. Like, there was like an Alice in Chains set list from 1992. I'm like, holy shit. And it's it kind of like you said, I kind of got the feeling it was very like Jan Wenner, David Frick take on rock and roll, like opening up a Rolling Stone album guide and starting from the beginning. But I certainly wasn't bored. I mean, I think it's such a hard thing to quantify. It probably does as good a job as one could hope. I mean,
I would almost be willing to agree with that.
Okay.
Except I'll say this, and this is sort of, maybe this is what spoiled me. If you go to the top floor of the new Smithsonian Museum of African American History in Washington, it is the best music museum I've ever seen in the United States.
No kidding.
It's incredible. And to me, it is what these museums should represent. It is it's dynamic and it's physical. There are these interactive parts, but you also see these you see wardrobes, you see instruments, you see records, but they're all with such context and they're all with such power. It's not like the dude from the Moody Blues gave us this thing, so we put it in the museum. Deal with it. It's like, this is here for this reason.
The Knights in White Satin. Right?
Yeah. And I think that's the thing about that museum, about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, is it's like, someone gave us this, so here it is. And it's like, okay, I don't care. But the Smithsonian, and you know, it has the benefit, obviously, of being in the Smithsonian. But it's really purposeful and it's really deliberate, and everything you see, you're like, I get why this is here. I can take a few different meanings away from it, but I also get the purpose of it, and it's really intentional. And that was incredible to me.
Like, I sort of felt that way about seeing the Country Music Hall of Fame in Nashville, which I think does a better job than like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in terms of presenting like the origins of country and covering things like bluegrass and Texas swing and the Carter family and whatnot. That was if you haven't been there, that place is great as well.
Yeah, no, it is amazing. Yeah, and I think the onus of museums is almost not to just present like a panoply of things, but is also to tell us why it's presenting things and to say, here's the story, here's the narrative we're trying to share and build, and here's why we think that narrative is significant. Mm-hmm. And I think the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame kind of misses the mark in that respect by trying to do too much with too much.
Well, it kind of just so much assumes that you care about it when you should be able to walk into a museum without much care for what the subject is and walk out feeling like you are like invigorated by it to a certain degree because you've learned that origin, you've learned that story, you've learned all the pieces that make it whole.
It's like being a Christian and going to summer Jesus camp and leaving and being like, fuck yeah, Jesus rules.
Right, exactly.
and then being like, I don't know.
Yeah.
There are other religions.
When I went to Jewish youth group camp, it was more about Jewish kids smoking weed and listening to the Dead in the Woods. There was like,
man, I'm envious.
There was some religion. Not really.
Yeah, it's a different kind of gospel.
Very, very different.
I guess five like favorite metal albums so far, 2018.
Oh man, this is the worst kind of question for me. I don't know. I don't have an answer. Is that okay? I don't have an answer.
Okay. That's perfectly okay.
Yeah, people ask me for album recommendations, and I recently realized, while talking to a friend, that's just not how my brain works. He's just like, that's okay. She's like a therapist. And she's like, that's how my brain doesn't work that way either.
It's funny. When we talked to Steven, and I did recently an interview with a keyboardist, and it's kind of something we ask everyone, just because the whole point of our podcast is to take people from Phish and try to introduce them to this whole widespread realm of music based on if you like this improvisational segment that we're featuring for the week. In both situations, Haydn and Joel Cummins of Umphrey's McGee, when we asked them what their favorite records of the year were, they both immediately had to go to their Spotify recently played. And, you know, for people that write about music, for people that play music professionally, I totally get it. Like, you guys have, like, so much going on in your head, you know, from a musical standpoint, that, like, categorizing it in the moment's got to be tough.
I think I could tell you five records I really love that aren't metal.
Okay.
If that's okay. Right, that's okay?
Dude. Yeah, that's perfect.
Man, I'm totally just standing outside my van house thing. I might get the names wrong, but I'm going to try. So there's Damian Jurado's record, The Horizon Just Laughed, I think.
Okay.
I think Damian's been writing songs for releasing records for 20 years now. Yeah. Richard Swift made his last three records. He didn't make this one because he was, I don't think his health was up to snuff, so to speak. Sidebar, anyone listening who is not listening to Richard Smith's records should check him out. He's a tremendous force.
Totally back that up.
Who died not long ago. But Damien's record is I think the best record he's ever released, and I think probably the best singer-songwriter set I've heard this year. So there's that one.
Mr. Percy Faith, is your masterpiece complete? I'm in dire need of curing this headache. There are riots in the streets, and we're still not on the moon. And I hear that you've been taken from the airwaves. Joseph Raymond Conniff.
What do you think? I think maybe the Phish fans, and this probably isn't one of my favorite records of the year, but maybe like Phish fans could rally behind sort of the synthesis of music that's happening on a record by a guy named who goes by the name of Zill and Ardor, who's a European African American.
Okay.
And he was challenged on 4chan a few years ago to make music that combined black metal with black folk music. And so what he did was mix black folk songs and black metal. And the new record is really inspiring and incredible and difficult and imperfect. But
you remember that from Pitchfork, right?
I did, yeah.
Okay.
All right. So I think that's a good one to check out.
Thank you.
Let's see, what else? Scanning through my head here. There's so many records I'm going to be like, why didn't I say that? I can only think of the records I just pitched. Another one would be, well, the Sleep record, you know. Yes. All right, okay, let's go with the Sleep. Y'all talk about Sleep on this show?
We haven't, but we love Sleep. I certainly love Sleep.
All right.
The so science is great.
A rumor that I hear is that you like weed. Sorry for the reductive rumor, but I've heard that.
Well, what's great about Sleep is that they make the act of smoking marijuana sound like some incredible life-affirming quest that make it sound way more awesome than it is.
It's a divine right.
Right.
Yeah. You're going to walk through the desert and you're going to find Nazareth. Do it. So Sleep the Scientist is their first record in 20 years, 19 years, 21 years. And it's great. They've gotten better. They're the rare band who reunited and got better because they spent the last 20 years playing in different bands. So The Scientist is a really incredible record.
And they're funny.
The record is hilarious.
I know that you wrote about a record that we recently featured. Actually,
okay,
an episode that we're releasing tomorrow. We featured it in our new album recommendation. This is an album that Dave told me was like my wheelhouse, and I listened to it and I went to see a review of it, and it was written by you, the Tangents album New Bodies, which is just fucking mind blowing. I love that record so much.
Oh yeah, it's a great record. It's really good. I write a lot about instrumental music, and I think maybe something that I love to hear in instrumental music is I talked a little bit about ideas earlier, but I love to hear the articulation of an emotion or story. It's not easier to share an emotion or a story with words, but it can be a little more obvious. I don't want to detract from singer-songwriters or from songwriters in general, but the tools are a little more available and obvious. And so the Tangents record, I think, is a really good piece of instrumental music that they've been a really incredible band for a minute now. But now they're sort of getting to the core of what they're trying to say and saying these things that you can sort of live inside and have a feeling about. So that's a really great record. I mean, if you love like those Books records or if you love Fortet records, there's a record I wrote about as well earlier this year from a group called Entourage, who were sort of a collective 34 years ago that made a few records that Fortet actually sampled. A lot of that music reminds me, and there's a new box set of their music on the great label Tompkins Square. Their music reminds me a little bit of that, but it definitely has more of a sort of dynamic sensibility, a modern dynamic sensibility, more rhythm. But it's instrumental music that articulates an emotion as well as an idea. And I would say the last record that I would really feel like I would be really neglectful if I did not mention is the new Mary Lattimore LP.
Oh, she's a harpist.
Mary Lattimore is a harpist. But the amazing thing about the new Mary's new record is that she doesn't just play the harp. She sings a little bit. Mm-hmm. She plays some guitar, and she plays some keyboards. So she kind of, you know, she's been known as a harpist. She's played with Thurston Moore, and she's played with Sharon Van Etten. She's played with a lot of people. And
isn't she on tour with Ice Age, which is just a fucking awesome bill?
Yeah, she is on tour with Ice Age, which is an awesome and crazy bill. but you know, this record is, again, sort of similar to the Tangents record. It has a lot to say about the way it feels, about the world. And, you know, you can sort of imagine yourself living in these songs or thinking about the meaning of these songs or why they were written and what they have to offer. It's also just really beautiful music. So that's a record that I would really recommend and that I think, you know, her credentials are impeccable if that's what you're into. You know, like she has an incredible resume and she has a really good catalog of solo recordings. But she is a person who I think this year has found kind of what she's been looking for in some way. Record also with Meg Baird from Espers and from Hair in Oblivion that is coming out. I don't know if it's been announced, but it probably will be by the time this is up. She has a new record with Meg that's incredible as well. It's voice and guitar and harp, and it's awesome.
Is she the singer from Hair in Oblivion?
Yep, and she was in Espers as well. Okay. Espers are a great band. If folks haven't checked out Espers, great band from Philadelphia, involved in the quote unquote freak folk scene.
Hair in Oblivion's got what's his name? Ethan Miller from Howlin' Rain, Comets on Fire.
Comets on Fire, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's great too.
They're very good.
Yep.
Excellent.
Absolutely.
Cool.
That's some great stuff. But yeah, we when we talked about that Tangents record, it was in an episode where we featured a Mark McGuire song from Living With Yourself that I would say is another instrumental record that just tells a complete story, really showcases like some just dynamic feeling and some dynamic like this big journey that he was on in terms of going back through his whole past. And something I think he does really well through his music, and definitely found a connection within that. I
Mark is definitely someone who's done something similar to both Mary and Tangents, I think, which is, you know, all like incredible technicians who have over the years developed this sort of personal vocabulary for sharing something more. And I think that's really rewarding. I think as a fan of instrumental or wordless music, a lot of times you'll find someone you're like, wow, that person's really good at what they're doing. I'm not taking a lot away from it. So whenever someone is able to develop that as well, it's really a gift, and I think they have the tools to sort of share it. So, well, yes, those are records I'd recommend.
It's a challenge that we see in the larger kind of jam band community that, like, Fish is a part of, and it's a lot of the reason why Dave and I do this podcast is there's a lot of bands out there that will play 20, 30-minute improvisational pieces that don't really tell a story. They're kind of just, you take a lead, you take a lead. And, you know, that's super fun for a lot of people. I'm not knocking it. I just, I tend to look at, if I'm going to look for instrumental music, if I'm going to look for something that's going to take me on kind of a journey, I want something that tends to have some deliberateness to it, some intentionality behind it, without, you know, really saying something, you know, without like, you know, verbally saying something.
I think you're always going to be able to find a great player, but being able to find someone who's able to take that playing and make you feel something or give you the opportunity to feel something is a more special experience.
Totally.
So
kind of, you know, one of the last big things we wanted to talk with you about was, you wrote a really wonderful essay that we're going to share when we post this, about kind of traveling and this experience you were having where you were finding yourself in parts of the country and in the Yukon where you had no Wi-Fi connection, and you were putting on CDs and you were kind of rediscovering listening to music through CDs. And I was curious, you know, as you're continuing, you know, on the road, have you found any new albums that have come to light kind of since publishing that article just through the medium of CDs that have really kind of struck you in a way that they hadn't before?
I think this is sort of a different answer. We got into Nebraska today. We're in Omaha right now. We just got into Nebraska. And, like, this is totally cheesy, but a record that I've been looking forward to for a year for listening to in a very specific setting is Nebraska. And so I don't know, actually, because, like, one of the things that I've really learned on this trip is that your sort of conceptions of your country, of the United States, or wherever you are probably, are pretty different from the reality of it.
Right.
And something I really love, one of my favorite parts of this country, are the Badlands. The thing about the Badlands is they're not really Nebraska. There are Nebraskan Badlands, but the Badlands that Springsteen references very specifically kind of only exist in part. I mean, they exist, but they're not like the Badlands that, like, you see all the time. In photos, or, you know, the Badlands National Park, of course, is above Nebraska in South Dakota. Which I sort of had less of a frame of reference for before this trip. So I'm really interested to hear this record, which, you know, of course, has Atlantic City, which is a place that we've been to on this trip, and references the Badlands and references so many things about this country. I'm excited to probably hear that tomorrow or the next day. At night, hopefully, and sort of see how I feel about it. It's a record that, like a lot of people, I heard the first time when I was a teenager. I was like, man, this is like spooky and affecting music. And, you know, it's always been something that's in my head, but I probably don't listen to that often. So I'm curious to see how I connect with it while in Nebraska. I've never been in Nebraska until today. It's one of the few states I've ever been to, and I have very little conception of what it's actually like.
Right.
So I'm kind of curious to see what that conception is squared with the album itself, which, you know, of course, has very little to do in the state of Nebraska, except in your mind, when you hear it when you're a kid, you're like, that entire album is about Nebraska, and it's not.
Right.
So I sort of think that answer is a little bit unwritten, and there are other records, obviously, I've listened to, but that's the one that right now is like, how is this going to feel? Like, what do I walk away from this adventure, this experience, thinking about this music that I've known for 25 years or whatever? So that's kind of what I'm excited about in that realm right now, is sort of hearing the way that my understanding of something reckons with my past understanding of something reckons with, like, the on the ground reality in the moment.
Yeah. It's funny. I have a very distinct memory of that album. I moved out of Missoula, Montana about 10 years ago this upcoming fall, and drove back to my home in Chicago before moving overseas and then living around the U.S. for a bit before finally settling here in Denver. And I remember listening to that record. I left Missoula at like 5 o'clock in the morning, and I was pretty, I knew I needed to leave. I knew that was like, that chapter of my life was over, but I was pretty beat up about it. You know, I didn't want it to be over. And I threw that album on as the sun was rising. I was driving through these kind of canyons on Highway 90 going east, and that, like, I still, like, have distinct memories of every song on that record. And that has nothing to do with Nebraska, and I wasn't being chased by a state trooper, and I wasn't, but it's one of those albums that, like, you can put it in 1,000 different places around the country. But I think it's cool, you know, listening to it in the state that gave it its name. I like that.
Yeah. I don't know the last time I heard it. You know, I sort of hear it I play it in my head every now and again, but I don't know the last time I actually put it on and listened to it. So I'm really curious to see how that goes.
Curious, kind of to that point, you know, you talked about traveling around America. You see the country in a very different way than you think about America when you're not in it. You're not traveling. Kind of this last like year and a half, you've been on the road since what, like last June, did you say?
Last April.
Last April. Okay. Obviously, you're on the road in a very interesting and contentious and kind of bombastic time in the country's history. What's kind of your overall impression of our country right now, and what's it been like being on the road as kind of conflicts continue to just like simmer and simmer, and it feels like they're going to boil over, you know, at kind of any moment?
Yeah. It feels in some ways like boiling over is not the worst thing that would happen for us.
Yeah.
That maybe we've got some things to really figure out, and that we treat as not pressing enough to let them boil over. That we really need to have a lot of intense, long conversations. And I don't know what form those conversations take. But we have he's got a lot of problems, and sort of driving around hasn't obscured those problems. I think the one thing it has made me realize, and Tina and I talk about this a lot, you find a lot of faith in America or the United States of America, but it's hard to sometimes find faith in Americans. Sometimes you're very disappointed in the things people say or the way they react to anything different than their sort of idea of what America should be. And I think that we have sort of stumbled into this incredible wealth of land and beauty and possibility, and we are fucking it up in a lot of ways. And I think we got to get we are way behind that, and we have to figure out how to catch up with that idea. And we have to, and I don't know what that looks like. I don't know if it's getting behind a politician or getting behind ourselves or starting over or, you know, I don't know. But I think the thing that really occurs to us is that we are all longing for, like, this myth of the American dream. It's very much a myth, and we hope that it becomes real, but we haven't really figured out how to make it available to people. And I think that something that's true and troublesome is that we sort of look at the rights that we think we have and been given, and we're not willing to compromise on those, or understand that they have limits, and that can be to the detriment of our fellow resident or citizen. And I think that's kind of what we have to do, is understand that this country and its hope that, you know, I mean, if you read the Gettysburg Address, you know, which I read again in Gettysburg for the first time in decades this year, and have since read again and again, it's sort of the question that was there when Abraham Lincoln wrote it, sort of as like the opening act for a speaker whose name I can never remember, on the way to Gettysburg, which is that this isn't like a foregone conclusion that America works. It's a test and like an idea and an experiment on that idea. And we constantly have to question it and fix it. And I think that's maybe what, after World War II, especially after Vietnam, we somehow stopped doing, is saying we got to make this better. We just said, well, it works. And it isn't working. I think we have a lot of questions to answer. And I think this year, in some way, was we sort of set out to do it after Donald Trump was elected. We thought about moving to Canada, but we decided to go out on the road instead. And it was, in a sense, to discover sort of hopefulness in America. And I think we found a lot of that, but we also found a lot of worry in the way that there's a lot of work to be done, and it's overwhelming. But I think that's a reason to engage with it, rather than run away from it, which is, I think, the decision we've made.
Yeah, I think it's, I think there's a lot of truth in that. And I think there's a lot of, kind of the uncertainty and the worry that people share is, I'm sure that you've seen this. I think it's on both sides. You know, I think it's, I don't know, it's hard to grapple with right now. I know that from my end, you know, what you and Tina are doing, your guys' messages, your guys' ability to kind of communicate your travels is super inspiring, and I think speaks to kind of that ongoing American curiosity for who we are, and trying to, like, peel back the pieces, even the kind of ugly pieces of what we've done wrong here in this country, and what we've also done right, and what we've gotten right, and what, you know, our best intentions are. And I think you guys have really, I mean, I know from following you guys on social media over the last year, I think you guys have summarized a lot of that up in a lot of ways, while also really showcasing the kind of confoundment that we all feel when we look around at the country and go, is this really where we're at? So I appreciate you speaking on that. I really do.
You bet.
Well, whatever you do, listen, you better wait for me. No, I wouldn't go out alone into America. Whatever you do, listen, you better wait for me. No, I wouldn't go out alone.
All right, guys. Hope that you enjoyed that conversation there with Grayson Curran. Like I said, we'll be sure to link some of the articles that we mentioned there and that we discussed to give you guys a little bit better context, but we hope that you guys enjoyed that really soulful conversation with Grayson. Some really amazing things that he had to say about the state of music, as well as what it's like traveling around America right now at this very I guess unique is the nice way to put it, period, in our history.
And if you have gotten anything from that interview, it's that you should listen to the Sleep album, Dope Smoker, and drop out of life, yes, with bong in hand and make the trek across Nazareth. And hear their new record, The Sciences, which is really, really good. So, and on that note, I'm David Goldstein.
I am Brian Brinkman.
And we hope you enjoyed that interview with Grayson Curran. And come back shortly, in a week or two, we'll have another piping hot episode of some fish, some non-fish, all good things in between. Join us as we go beyond.
Somewhere in middle America, give it right to the heart of matters. It's a heart that matters more. Think you better turn your ticket in. Get your money back.
Osiris.